Good morning, ladies. We are studying today Parashat Ki Tetzeh. Today's Divrei Torah is in memory of Linda Bat Bahia, known as Linda Cohen, Alea Shalom, who passed away within the year. Although she suffered sickness for over a decade, but after talking to the family, she did not give the impression of a sick woman. She was known to be a lady with good spirit and upbeat, beloved by everyone, especially her dear husband Nathan, that nursed her for all those years and took care of her. And Baruch Hashem, she's in a better place, as they say, and she could take pride that she did raise a beautiful family, children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren also. May her memory be blessed. Amen. Our parasha begins off, Ki tetze lamelchama al oyebecha, that when you will go out to war against your enemy, untano Hashem Elohecha biyadecha, and God will deliver the enemy into your hands, v'shavita shivyo, and you will take captives. Of course, the simple explanation of this parasha is a physical war. There's an enemy, the Jewish army musters itself up, and they go out and they battle with the ammunition, with all the strategies. But the rabbis of Musar, they have a different take on the opening verse of our parasha. They are referring to a different type of war or battle that we are engaged in against our enemy on a daily basis. Daily basis is even too long, even on a moment-to-moment basis. That enemy is referring to the Yetzer Hara. That enemy is the evil inclination. That bug that's in us that entices us to do wrong. He's the enemy. He wants to see us make mistakes. He wants to see us fail. The pasuk says, "Ki tetze lamelchama al oyevecha," that in order to beat the yetzer hara, this evil inclination, this urge, you must go to war against it. But you must go out to war, which means it has to be a preemptive strike. You cannot wait until you're in the confines of sin to start fighting the yetzer hara. It's too late. You have to fight the yetzer hara in an aggressive war, ki tetze lamelchama. It's offensive. How do you fight such a war? How do you beat the yetzer hara? This is the million-dollar question everybody wants to know. How do you conquer this urge to do wrong? So that she gives us a little insight. He says, ki tetze lamelchama b'melchemet hareshut hakatuv medaber. Now she says, what type of war is this talking about? A voluntary war, an optional war. Which means there's certain wars that there's a mitzvah to fight, like Amalek, it's a mitzvah to go fight. And then there's just a war where you want to expand the borders of Israel, so that's an optional war. So this parasha happens to be talking about optional war. We call that milchemet hareshut. But based on what we're interpreting today, then it's really referring to the Yetzer Hara, the common enemy of man. The pasuk is saying, and how you fight Yetzer Hara? You fight him on the things that are permissible. What does that mean, on the things that are permissible? Which means we must make fences around the Torah so we don't come to transgress the actual law itself. Many of the laws that we have today are just fences. But the fence protects a person from getting to the actual sin itself. And therefore there's a value to what we call takanot or gezerot. The Yetzer Hara must be fought in the permissible area of life, in order that you do not come to the forbidden area.
Rashi says, "Bemilchemet hareshut." The war has to be in the area that's permissible, in the reshut, not in the obligatory area. A simple example. The Torah says we're allowed to accept converts. Torah doesn't only say we're allowed to, but it says how much we have to treat them with open arms, with hospitality, with niceness. You have to love them. That's the law. But our great rabbis of 50, 60 years ago, Hakam Yaakov Katzin alav shalom in specific, understood that offense must be made on such a law. Because in American society, if we allow our people to marry converts, who knows if people will make conversions for their own reasons, conversions just to get married, where it's really not sincere, and they'll revert back to their old ways, and God forbid it can compromise the integrity of the entire community. So they made an edict, we cannot accept converts. But what do you mean, Rabbi? That's something that's permissible, you're allowed. But to fight the Yetzer Hara, you can't fight the Yetzer Hara at the wedding. It's too late already. Why, you're going to make a stink at the wedding? Does anybody object this? Forever hold their peace. Now you're going to stand up and say, well, I object. It's too late, nobody's canceling a wedding. You have to make the protest 10 miles before the sin. And therefore he came along and made a fence. And it was a stroke of prophecy. That one edict probably saved our community from looking like other Jewish communities. Even other Sephardic Jewish communities around the world that are plagued by intermarriage. That's what we call a gezerah. To the young men that we try to get them up for minyan in the morning, we tell them, don't fight the Yetzer Hara at 5:30 in the morning. There's no way you'll beat them. You're sleeping in bed, weary-eyed, and the Yetzer Hara has been up for 8 hours strategizing how he's going to get you to put the snooze button on. So there's no way you're going to be able to beat him at that moment, at the time of the test. You know when you have to beat the Yetzer Hara the night before? Go to sleep on time. Somebody said, put your alarm clock on the other side of the room. Now you have to get up because you don't want to be annoyed by the buzzer. So you're going to have to get out of your bed just to shut it. Once you're up already, finished, you're up already. Got you out of bed. B'milchemet hareshut, you have to fight the war. You have to make defense. Not just because it's permissible, does it mean it's a mitzvah. Just because something is allowed, doesn't mean you have to do it. You know, you're allowed to eat. So now, are we going to propose that you can just sit down and eat all day long? Well, it's not a sin, I'm allowed to eat all day long. But what is it going to lead to, such behavior? It's going to lead to the wrong things, to bad behavior. That's the way we fight the Yetzer. We make fences, like a father told his son, I don't want you walking in the street. So I understand you, Dad. So he walked to the curb of Ocean Parkway, and he's standing right on the curb, and cars are whizzing by. And the father comes to the son and hits him. Get away from the street. Dad, you told me don't go in the street. I'm not in the street. He says, yeah, that's the law. But now we're putting a fence. I don't want you to walk 5 feet from the street. So you won't come to fall into the street. You see how important the fence is? So you can not only be concerned in, is it asur? What's the strict law? We're not interested in strict law. We're also interested in the fence that protects us from getting to the sin. That's where our efforts have to be placed. The Pasuk then says, V'shavita shivyo, and you'll take captives. But I wanted to explain the Pasuk maybe in a different light. The Yetzer Hara, this evil inclination, you should know, is with us from the, let's say, the day we're born. It kicks in more when you're bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah, and it lives with us till the day we die, after 120. So nobody could say, I'm good, I'm 50 years old, I conquered my Yetzer Hara, I can relax. The moment the Yetzer Hara sees a little complacency, boom, he comes in. Even the biggest tzaddik, there was a Kohen Gadol, his name was Yohanan. He was a Kohen Gadol for 80 years. Imagine that, Kohen Gadol. Holiest man. You figure, oh, this guy, that's it. It's a shoo-in. It's guaranteed. After 80 years of being a Kohen Gadol, he turned into a Tzeduki. Tzeduki is like the old version of a Reformed Jew. Guy was, he wasn't Orthodox, he was the most extreme religious man. 80 years later, the guy found himself in the Reformed Temple in Tzeduki. To show you what the Gemara says, Al ta'amin bi'atzmecha ad yom motcha. You can never trust yourself. You always have to be vigilant. You always have to be on guard. The Yitzhak waits for a little weakness. Oh. And he sees the weakness and he takes advantage. It's like an addiction. There was a fellow that was an alcoholic. And he went to the different therapies and he recovered. He was a recovering alcoholic. This fellow had to be a doctor himself. After many years, I think he was recovered for about 25 years. He had an ailment of some sort. He went to his doctor. His doctor prescribed him a medicine. The medicine gave him a bad reaction, high blood pressure. So the doctor told him, listen, in order to bring down your pressure, we have to first take you off this medicine, and you're going to have to take a Valium every day. Valium. So he says, no, doc, listen, 25 years ago I had an addiction to alcohol, and with my addiction to alcohol, I also used to be addicted to Valium. So I don't think it's a good idea to give me Valium. He said, no, don't worry about it. First of all, I'm only giving you 0.5 grams. You can't get addicted from 0.5 grams. It's nothing. And I'm not giving you the bottle. I'm giving your wife the bottle, and she's going to give you a pill every day. So there's no, you won't relapse. It's okay. His wife gives him the pills. The first day she gives him a pill. He doesn't take it, he puts it in his pocket. The second day she gives him a pill, he puts it in his pocket. Third day the same. The fourth day, now he had four pills. He took all four pills in one shot. Oh, now he felt the high of the Valium. And he did that every 4 days. He took four pills until slowly, he found himself back into addiction. And his life started to spiral downwards. And you ask yourself, where did this come from? From a little laxity. From a little 0.5. Yetzirah found a hairline crack. And boom. Came right in and destroyed him again. Yetzirah is very patient. And therefore it waits for that opportunity when you're off guard. And sets in and gets you. So you have to be vigilant. That's what the Pasuk might be meaning when it says, Veshavita Shivyo. Of course, I'm taking the Pasuk out of its natural context, but we might say the word Veshavita comes from the Hebrew word Neshev. Neshev means to sit. Veshavita, once you sit and relax and you're complacent, Shivyo, he conquers you. Once already you take your mind off the war, Veshavita, you want to take it easy a little? I'm good. Shivyo. Then you become his captive. So although the Pasuk might not have applications to a physical war, but I think the lessons to that spiritual war that we're fighting is very, very important. Number one, Ki tetzeh la-milchama. You have to take the offensive in fighting the Yetzer. You fight him in milchemet ha-reshut. You have to fight him in the areas of life that are permissible in order that you don't come to make sin. Don't put yourself in a situation. But I'm allowed to be there. But you know if you're there, you're going to talk Lashon Hara. You know if you're there, you're going to do the wrong thing. But I'm allowed to be there. But fight him in the permissible area, in the reshut, so you won't come to the Isur. And the last lesson from this first pasuk is Veshavita Shivyo. Never put your guns down. Never rest up. Because then, he will conquer you. Now this next part of the parasha is very difficult to explain. It says that the soldiers are in this war. They're going to see one of the captives, a lady. V'hashaktaba. And the soldiers can have a desire for her. So it says, he takes her into the house. She's not even Jewish. I'm taking a risk to even enter this subject of the parasha, but I think there's a valuable point. It's such a complicated subject. It's a Jewish man in a war. It's a non-Jewish lady. Takes her into captivity. The Torah allows this. Doesn't allow it today, God forbid, and it doesn't allow it off the field of battle. It's an exceptional law. So it says, after he takes them from the war, we try to see if the feelings are really true. So it says she has to shave all her hair off. She has to grow her nails long in order, they want to make her look unattractive in order to dissuade the guy from being with her. It's interesting to point out that Pasuk writes, one of the things that we make her look ugly is ve'asetat ziponeh, that they would make her nails grow long. It seems that that fashion changed at some point in history. In the olden days, long nails were considered not an attractable thing. Today, people go to stores and they extend their nails. They buy different type of attachments. I saw people in the city like claws that they're walking with long. So that changed, it seems. In any event, it says after the process, it's a month process where she's just sitting in her house crying all day long, whatever she's doing. It says ve'achar ken, after that tavo eleha uva'alta, he's with her. And after he's with her, the pasuk says ve'haya, in the event im lo hafatz taba, if you don't really want her afterwards, you could send her back to her father's house. The problem with this parasha is the pasuk says, and in the event im lo hafatz taba, after you're with her, it says, if you did not want her. Now that's the wrong tense. It should say, after you're with her, if you don't want her in the present, send her back. But it doesn't say that. The Torah uses the past tense, im lo hafatzta. After you're with her, if you realize that you didn't want her, what do you mean? That's past. It should say that you don't want her. The explanation is very, very important. That many times, people are influenced. They think they want something out of love, but little do they know that it's not love that's driving them, it's passion, it's desire. Like the pasuk says, he sees a beautiful girl, the hashakta. Doesn't say he loves her, but he has a desire for her. But you ask the guy, so I love her, I love her. He doesn't love her, he loves himself. And therefore, the Torah says, you know when you'll know if you love her or not? After the person's desire is finished. After it's finished, then you can see retroactively, im lo hafatz taba, which is then you're able to say, the truth is, I really didn't want her. I didn't like her for what she is. It was personal. To show you at the time of passion, there is no objectivity. After you're with her, then you can look back and say, the truth is, I never wanted her. It wasn't her, I wanted myself. The reason why I tell you this, Hiddush, ladies, is because many of us have children that we want to marry. The venue that today our children meet can really be questioned. We'll all agree that marriage is from the top priorities that we have for our children. We want them to marry well, marry good, good families, good people. But the places where we put our children to meet are less than desirable. First of all, it happens in the wee hours of the morning, party at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning, where everybody already is tired, they cannot make rational decisions. It's made over a drink, so already the brain is not making proper decisions. It's made in pitch black. There's no light, you can't see anything. And it's made with a very, very loud music. And they want children at 2 in the morning, half drunk, in the dark, with pounding music, to find the girl that they're going to marry. And then a girl comes in front of that person, dressed immodestly. How do you expect a child to make an objection or objective decision? He's tainted already. He can't think. He finished. His hormones kicked in. He cannot make an objective decision. He comes home, mommy, I love her. And now the parent says, what do you mean? But this is not our people. We don't know the mother, the father, the grandfather. There's a story, there's history. No, I'm going to marry him. I'm going to marry her. Finished. It's over. And now sometimes it's too late. Now we can just tell him he got zapped. And then unfortunately what happens is after they get married, in some cases unfortunately, after he satisfies his passion, he realizes, I never wanted her. I never liked her. And then already, chas v'shalom, we know where these type of marriages end up. The old-fashioned way of shidduch, of setting our children up, makes so much more sense. It's business. There's a girl from this family, we investigate, we know everybody is. It's a boy from this family, we investigate, no surprises. All the legwork is done before they even meet for the first time, that you know it's compatible. Then, in a proper setting, they meet. If there's chemistry, good. If not, next. But there's less chance for disaster. The decision is being made from intellect, not from passion. And that's a very important lesson, that we have to be vigilant parents to make sure that our children, when they start to date, that they don't get swept up into the wrong place. And then it's, if you're lucky, you're able to talk them out of it. You have to be lucky to talk them out of it. Because in most cases, the children are adamant. Children always think they know better than their parents. No, you're old-fashioned, you don't know, I'll show you. And unfortunately, sometimes when it doesn't work out the right way, it can be disastrous. We have to be the objectivity for our children. When it comes to marriage, they're blinded. It's passion. Even to the girls. Here's a boy, wines her and dines her, shows a little affection, shows a little love, finish. She loves the boy. But the boy's not from our way, it's not from our people. It's, look at all the problems, look at all the issues. No, she loves the boy, finished. That's where the job of the parent is, to come and provide vision to the child, because the child has a blind side. The child cannot see past his desire. It's cheshek, like the Torah says. And that has to be, as we said, hands-on parenting, to know exactly who our children are talking to, who they're socializing with, in order that we can put an ounce of preventive medicine, in order that we don't have to deal with pounds and pounds of problems that arise if we were not careful. The next subject in Perasha is the story of a Ben Sorer u'More. What is this Ben Sorer u'More? It's a wayward, rebellious son. The story is, there's a boy, and he's rebellious, he's vulgar, he's untamed, he drinks, he's a glutton, he's involved in all sorts of uncontrollable behavior. So the Torah says his parents have to bring him to the court, or in the event that the parents bring this child to the court and they tell the judges, our son is wayward, he's rebellious, he doesn't listen to us. Torah says they take the child and they stone him. Go slow. The Gemara says that this really never happened. There was never a case where this exactly panned out, where there was a child that did these things and suffered the consequence of punishment. So the Gemara says, if it never happened, why write me a hypothetical story? The Gemara's answer is, drosh v'kabel sachar. Yeah, at least you have another perasha that you could learn, and you'll get credit for learning it. Although it never happened, but then now we have a chance to talk about another pasuk in the Torah. There's a whole chapter in Masechet Sanhedrin, the whole chapter talks about the Ben Sorer u'More. So I always was bothered with that Gemara. Well, we don't have enough Torah to learn, that you have to give me an extra parasha to get credit if I learn it? Well, the rabbis are not busy enough with all the other 1,000 books on the bookshelf. So the Gemara, yeah, here's another subject. Let the rabbis keep busy and learn it. I'll get credit for the learning the Pesukim. We can't finish the stuff we have already. Now they're putting more stuff on top of us that never happened. What does it mean, drosh v'kabel sachar? Learn it and you'll get reward. What I think it might mean is that although the ben sorer umore, that wayward kid who ate the meat and drank the wine and doesn't listen to his parents, although there might not have been that prototype that actually got the punishment of the Torah, but I think there's a lot of lessons the Torah is telling us as parents that we could learn from how the child got to where he got and the reaction of the parents, what they did when they found out about it. The pasuk might, the Gemara might be saying, drosh, learn this parasha and it'll be very rewarding to you and might give you some pointers and tips in parenting. So although in the halachic technicality the case might never have happened, but if you learn the parasha well, it'll make you a better mother. It'll make you a better father. There's a lot of good technique in parenting, good parenting and bad parenting, that can be drawn out of this parasha. One example, something you don't see too often today. Look at the old-fashioned parent. The kid was misbehaving. The kid was uncontrollable. An unbridled child. What did the parents in the olden days do? They brought him to the Beit Din and said, we have a wayward child. Imagine that. The parents of the kid bring the kid to the police station. Lock him up. Put him in jail. He's not behaving the right way. Look at the difference in parenting in the olden days of Torah than today. Today, unfortunately, parents think that they're giving love to their children by allowing them to continue their addictive lifestyle. They give them money, they cover it up, they deny it. Nah, it's not so bad. He's going through a phase. He'll get over it. And meanwhile, the child is deteriorating. And in the name of love, the parent has misplaced mercy on the child. Today, the psychologists talk about a concept called tough love, where the parent sometimes, in the name of love of the child, and in the name of helping the child, has to be tough. Because if the child is not going to receive help, he's going to crash. We took all our children to the pediatrician when they were infants to get immunized. No mother wants to see their little infant get a shot this big in their leg. And the doctor warns you that the child's going to be in pain for 3 days. But God forbid if a parent didn't immunize his child or her child. That's tough love. We're doing something that although hurts us to do, but we know that our children won't get measles because of it, and mumps, and rubella, and all the other diseases. Sometimes we have to do something that's uncomfortable to protect the child. In the olden days, they did that. Don't say the neighbors called the police on the kid. The parents called the police. Take him away. Let him learn a lesson. Let him sit in jail one night. Then he'll know exactly how to behave. It's the difference between today when our children come home from the yeshiva and the child says, the rabbi yelled at me. The rabbi hit me. Right away, I'm going to call that rabbi. How dare he scream at you? How dare he put his hand on you when you call up? In the olden days, a child came home and said, the rabbi hit me. The rabbi hit you? And the parents are hitting the kids. The rabbi's right. Why did he hit you for? You must have misbehaved. You must have done something wrong. Make sure he doesn't hit you again. This was tough love. Not showing misplaced mercy on our children. And this is what the Torah is telling you. That the parents over here, they did what they're supposed to do in the sense that to help the child, sometimes you have to be a little strong. If a child needs to go to a place of rehabilitation, the mother might say, Hazit, I'm going to send him to Pennsylvania, it's too far away, there's no food for him, what is he going to eat? He's going to miss the holidays, all his friends. Let him stay home. We'll watch him. They think they're doing their children a service. They're doing him the biggest disservice. If he goes away for a little couple of months, they'll change him maybe, and it'll be good for the rest of his life. But because she had some misplaced mercy for a few months, now go right back to his bad ways. It's the parents that have to be the ones that convict the child, that are tough with the child. Unfortunately today, good parents, they saw that there's a problem of drinking at the parties. So in the name of compassion to their children, they said, our children are drinking. It's nice, they're having a good time, it's festive, but we don't want them to drive home, they can hurt themselves, so we're going to give them a driver. We'll give them a free limousine, we'll take their keys away because we're responsible parents, and now our children can do whatever they want, and they could know that they'll be driven home door to door without any problems. Is this helping the community? I said in Seudat Shlishit a few weeks ago, if it was up to me, of course I'd take the keys away from them, that's for sure. And I'd let them drink, and let them fall asleep on Norwood Avenue, and let them wake up wallowing in their drunkenness Sunday morning and say, where am I? And they'll be so dizzy, how did I get here? And they'll be so shamed, that'll teach them a lesson. That's what's going to happen. You're going to drink, you're going to be left. You're on your own. Nobody's going to deal with you. Parents are not going to let you in the house if you come home drunk. Oh, now the child will think twice. But what makes our children think twice today? What does he think? Beautiful. I was waiting for them to do this for me. They're going to give me a lift home now? Phenomenal. Now you can go without any conscience, without any problems. This is misplaced mercy. Doesn't say in the Torah when this kid was drinking that the mother said, come no, here's better wine. The contrary, the mother saw the kid drinking, the mother took the kid, come, you're coming to the police. Ma, you're going to convict me, yeah, you're going to the police. But you're my mother, because I love you. In the name of love, you're going to sit in jail for a day. But there might be another lesson besides the tough love message that we learned from the Ben Sorer Umureh story. One of the things it says, why it never happened, this case, because the Gemara put so many restrictions on the story, it's impossible for it to ever happen. One of the restrictions the Gemara says is that for Ben Sorer Moreh to manifest, his parents have to have a similar voice. Now that's very, very strange. You don't find that a mother and a father have the same voice. Mother's voice is usually a little higher, man's voice a little deeper. And if they do have the same voice, there's something going on, there's a problem. The Gemara's language is kolan shavim. Their voice must be equal. But we can learn a lesson from that as parents. That if we want our parents, if we want our children to come out normal and decent, the tone of our parents' voice could be different, but the message has to be the same. In parenting, our children need to get a unified message from both parents. Their voices must be equal. Their parenting techniques must be the same. If one parent is strict and the other parent is permissive, then the child is able to escape. Then he's able to play them against each other. But daddy said I could go. But I'm your mother, I said you can't go. But my daddy said yes. And now already he puts them against each other like Napoleon, divide and conquer, and he escapes. In such a case, the child was not culpable. Because the parents were not unified. What do you expect from the kid? In some homes you have a different voice by mother and father regarding religion. The father wants a religious household. The mother's not interested. The father goes into the boy's room at 7 o'clock, get up for minyan, get up for minyan. And the mother's there, let him sleep. Oh, Zit, he's tired, Sunday morning. And now the kid hears his parents arguing over his bed. He has to go to shul. He's a kid, leave him alone. He's going to go to shul the rest of his life. Let him sleep. No, we have to train him. And there's a mahloket. Meanwhile, what's the kid doing in the interim? He's sleeping. Finished, he escaped. By the time they finish this argument, it's mincha time. He missed shul already. So here you see how important it is that parents unify their techniques in parenting in order that the child receives a consistent message. And not mixed messages, that our children become confused. And that's what maybe the Gemara means when it says, if their parents' voices are not the same, there's no law of Ben Suridim, because the child is not guilty in such a case. What do you expect? He got confused from his parents. Furthermore, in Perasha, just want to make one point, an addendum to this last idea. I think it would be a good idea, before our children get married, we provide for the marriage classes, which is integral. The laws of the mikveh, the laws of shalom bayit, how to behave, how to talk, how to act. It might not be such a bad idea to also provide our children with some pointers on parenting. Why do we take it for granted that they're going to know how to parent children? Parenting children is much more complicated than driving, and we all took road tests, we all took written tests. So why do we think that raising children doesn't need it? We'll wing it, you know, we'll try this, we'll try that. And by the time we figure it out, the child's 18 years old already. Now it's too late. And therefore, it might not be such a bad idea for our children before they become parents. Just to, of course, you can't teach them everything, but just the basic concepts, hitting, not hitting, rebuking, not rebuking, bedtime, playtime, the major rules that you have to know, just that are fundamental. Then, of course, as the cases come up, they can go further. It might not be, maybe it's an idea that the time has come for such an idea, with all the classes that we provide in the community, that maybe to provide some, again, like I said, some preventive medicine to our children, so when they become parents, they have a little edge on life. The next subject in Perasha, it says, "Lo tir'eh et hamor achicha, o shoro nofelim baderech v'talamta mehem, hakem takim emmo." The Torah is talking about a case where you see hamor achicha, your brother's donkey. It's on the road, and it falls, it collapses. Torah says you have an obligation to go help him. You're on your donkey also. You see a guy, he collapsed, the donkey collapsed. You have to get off your donkey, say, listen, you need help, let me help you up, let me pick the packages up for you, let me set you up. Hakem takim emmo. You must stand them up with him. There's a rabbi called the Meshech Chochmah. He says that this pasuk, this subject of helping somebody's donkey that fell, it's actually written in Sefer Shemot. This is a repeat. Like I told you, a lot of the things in the book of Devarim are repetitive to stuff that was mentioned already in a previous book. He says, but when the Torah mentions it the first time, there's one change. It doesn't call it the donkey of your brother, but the Torah uses the language Hamor Sona'acha, your enemy's donkey. So it went from being your enemy's donkey to this parasha where it's your brother's donkey. What's the difference? The Gemara says, what do you mean enemy? What do you mean enemy? Are Jews allowed to have enemies? I thought you have to love everybody. How could you have an enemy? There's no case. So the Gemara says, yes, it's talking about a case where there was a guy that committed such a sin, a brazen sin, illicit sin, where the Torah says you're allowed to hate the guy. Because he's a bad guy. So in the first parashah it says, Hamor sunacha, where it's a justified hate. You're allowed to hate the guy. Still the Torah says, help him out. But in this parashah it says, it's your brother. So the Mishnah Ruchmat says, what changed? So he says like this. It's in the beautiful explanation that has a very important application. The first time this parasha was written, it was before the sin of the Egil, before the sin of the golden calf. It was before the Jewish people sinned. This parasha was written after the golden calf. And the attitude of a person changes before he sinned to after he sinned. Before the Jewish people did the Egil, they were pure. They didn't commit a sin, so when they saw somebody that committed a sin, they had a right to hate him. They had a right to keep away from that guy, which you always have a right, but they had a right to have negative feelings towards him, because they were pure. Therefore the Torah says, Chamor sunacha, it's your enemy. But after the Jewish people did the Egel, after they worshipped the golden calf, now even if they come into contact with a sinner, they cannot have that holier than thou attitude. Now it's your brother, because you did the same thing. What, now all of a sudden, I'm bad? You forgot that you bowed down to the Egel? Before the sin was done, then already, yes, you're able to be better and greater, and you can even hate. But after you yourself committed sin, after the Egel, even the sinner is called your brother, because you have no right to ostracize him. That's a great lesson that I learned when we see the great Teshuvah movement that's sweeping the world, including our community. And one symptom of a Baal Teshuvah, it's something that they grapple with internally, is that they cannot tolerate anybody. After they saw the light, and after they got the vision, and after they were born again, so now anybody that's not like them, they can't talk, have to shun them, can't look. So it's an attitude of holier than thou, but they forget that yesterday you were like me. Yesterday you were doing the same thing as everybody else. God bless you. Baruch Hashem, you got inspired. You saw God. You're with Him. You're doing the right thing. But to have an attitude now, everybody else is bad. If you were born in the Asha'arim and you lived a pure life your whole life, such a man could have such attitudes that he cannot tolerate sin, because he was never there. He's clean. But somebody that was there, Baruch Hashem, they came back. We're thrilled that they came back. But to have negative attitudes, maybe those people will come back one day as well, like you did. You forgot so fast. You forgot where you were. We're not allowed to remind them. It's avon to go to somebody that made teshuvah and say, oh, we remember you used to do this and you used to do that. You cannot bring up the past of somebody. That's a sin. It's very painful that somebody is trying to forget his past and you go and remind somebody of it. But he should remember it. We can't remind him, but the person himself has to remember it himself where he was. And therefore when he looks at other people, he has to say, God willing, they'll come around also. But in the meantime, he has to be accepting. He has to be loving. He has to be tolerant, as we talked about. Yeah, before the Jewish people did the sin of Egel, no tolerance. Shona acha, it's my enemy. After you tasted sin, you know what it is, it becomes your brother. And Be'ezat Hashem, that's the way you can bring him back. That's the way you can bring him back to your side. Not by pushing him away by those feelings. Torah then talks about the mitzvah of Shiluah Hakan. That's the story of a person that sees a bird's nest There's a mother bird, and the mother bird is sitting on the eggs, and he wants the eggs. So the Torah tells us, you must shoo the mother bird away and take the eggs. This is a mitzvah. Not only is it a mitzvah, if it comes to you, it's a mitzvah that you're rewarded with long life. Comes the Gemara and says, how interesting. There's only two mitzvot in the Torah that the Torah promises long life. This, the bird's nest, and honoring your parents. So the Gemara says, look, this is the easiest mitzvah, and you get long life. Honoring parents is the hardest mitzvah, and you get long life. To teach you that we can't figure out the reward for mitzvot. You just when you start to think, oh, this must be an important mitzvah, we get more reward. This is less important, less reward. Don't try to figure it out. This is the easiest of the mitzvot. You get the same reward for the hardest of the mitzvot. You can't figure out God's wisdom. We don't have the scale to measure what's important and what's not. Just do all the mitzvot. You know, a person might say, well, this is what I'm not going to do. It's not so important. You never know. Could be that's going to be the same reward for a much harder mitzvah. Then we have to keep them all. But I once heard an explanation. What makes this mitzvah easy, and what makes kibud ab va'em, honoring parents, difficult? The simple explanation is how hard it is to shoo a bird away. You see a bird's nest, go like this, clap your hands, whatever, you kick it away, and you take the eggs. It's just easy. It's no thought. Honoring parents is very difficult. Somebody mentioned this morning to me, and I think he's 100% right. Why is it the hardest mitzvah? This is because no matter what you do, it's never enough. It's just one of those mitzvot, you could never do enough for them. You can't say, look, I did this, I did my obligation. That's not true. You just started. It's almost impossible to reciprocate for what parents do for a child. It's one of those endless mitzvot. You went to the end of the world. It's still not enough. You wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them. So you have to go back and forth 100 times to the world, to the end of the world. And that's still not enough. But I wanted to say a little deeper. What makes this mitzvah easy and what makes kibud avim hard? What's the rationale behind this mitzvah? Why can't you just keep the mother bird there and just pick it up a little and take the eggs? Why do you have to shoo the mother bird away first? The Ramban writes, because the Torah is trying to train you to be compassionate. You're going to take the eggs in front of the mother? It's going to make you cruel. It's going to make you cold. It's going to make you insensitive. The Torah wants to develop character. And therefore, when you want the eggs, fine. But do it in a way that will make you a better person. If you're going to have compassion on a mother bird, that'll trickle down. You'll have compassion on your family. You'll have compassion on your friends. We want you to get used to nice behavior. It's the right thing to make you a better person to shoo the mother bird away. It's to breed compassion. You know why that's easy? Because compassion comes natural to all of us. You see somebody that's down and out, an automatic reaction is, we have to help them. We have to get them money. We have to set them up. We have to do something for them. Compassion comes natural to every person. We hear a sad story about someone that's going through difficult times. All of a sudden, without even controlling it, we start to shed a tear. It's easy to do a mitzvah that's in sync with our emotions. Rachmanut, sensitivity we have. Kibud avim, however, is a very hard mitzvah. Why? Because you know what the root of honoring parents is? Gratitude. And gratitude does not come natural for human beings. Gratitude is very difficult for human beings. You know why? Because human beings are created with a wanting to give and not receive. Nobody wants to receive. We all want to be givers. Nobody wants to be a taker. And we all have pride. And we all have egos. And when one shows gratitude, what he's really saying, it's an admission. I needed you. You did something for me. I'm beholden to you. And that goes against the grain of human beings. To admit that they needed the grace of somebody else. It's very hard to show gratitude in such a thing. Everybody's macho. Everyone's like, I could have done it myself. I don't need anybody's help. And that's why we have such a difficult time. I'm not saying the thank yous that we say to the grocer. That thank you doesn't mean anything. He gives you milk. Thank you very much. That thank you is a dime a dozen. That thank you is worthless. I'm talking about the thank you that a spouse has for each other, that children have. It's easy to say thank you to the mailman for the mail than to say thank you for your mother for dinner. Because you know that you don't owe the mailman anything. So the thank you is just perfunctory. But if you're going to start saying thank you to your mother for dinner, you're going to start to think to yourself, only dinner? Thank you for my existence. Thank you, that it never ends. Then you're going to realize how beholden you are. It's not easy to be grateful. That's why, unfortunately, we find many people that are not grateful people. Fellow came home. His wife made him dinner. After he finishes, she says, you're not going to say thank you? So he says, what? You made it for yourself also. You also ate. What, you weren't going to eat tonight? You just made it for me? You were eating also. So you put an extra cup of rice for me. You didn't go out of your way for me. You see how defensive we are? Anything to say thank you. Well, think of a million excuses. And you were going to pick up your dress from the cleaners anyway, so you picked up my suits. You didn't go for me. You went anyway. You have to thank you for that. For doing your errands, you have to thank you. You're getting a lift. Hey, he was going anyway down my block. I have to thank him for that. Why are you so defensive? Tell the person thank you. Because now I'm saying, no, I needed you. You helped me. You're taking. And that goes against human nature. And that's why it says the hardest mitzvah is kibud av va'em. Because we have to break that feeling of not wanting to admit that we needed the help from somebody else. Last but not least, the Torah tells us, right after this story of the bird, it says a person is going to build a house. He's going to build a new house. Torah says you must put a ma'akeh on your roof. What is a ma'akeh? In English they explain it as a parapet. What is a parapet? That's a fence on the roof. A roof could be dangerous. Children playing on the roof, people playing on the roof. We don't want anybody to fall off. So you have an obligation to make your house safe. So besides putting mezuzot, you have to make sure that there's a fence around the porch or around the roof so nobody falls off. You can't invite somebody to your house and God forbid you're going to put him in a dangerous situation. Now he leans back, he falls off the roof. So you have to have it fenced. That's a mitzvah. There's even a beracha you make when you put that fence. Rashi comes along and says, what's the connection between shooing birds and building a new house and putting a fence on the roof? So he says, the famous rule. Mitzvah goreret mitzvah. We have a rule. One mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. If you do one mitzvah, God will give you the opportunity to do another mitzvah. That's the way it works. Mitzvah usually come in bundles. They're not usually isolated events. Man comes to shul, he did one mitzvah. In shul, they solicit him for charity. Oh, that's another mitzvah. After you finish the synagogue, you want to stay 2 minutes for a class? That's a third mitzvah. On the way out, could you drive me to the train? That's a fourth mitzvah. All he went is for one, but he came home with four. Minimum. That's the way mitzvot are. They're contagious. One mitzvah leads to another mitzvah. So you never know what you're going to end up with. So the Torah says, this guy did a mitzvah, he saw a bird's nest, he shooed the mother away and he took the eggs, that's the mitzvah. So what does God do? He says, you did one mitzvah, I'm going to give you the opportunity now to do another mitzvah. I'm going to give you a plot of land, I'm going to give you the zichut to build a home, and now you're going to have a chance to put that fence on the roof. Comes out, ladies, that person, you ask him, what do you think about your new house? Wow, it's spacious, it's luxurious, bedrooms, backyard, front yard. Little does he know that the main part of that house is not the bathrooms and is not the dining room. But the whole reason why he got the house was in order to do that mitzvah of putting the fence on the roof. Because the first mitzvah led him to this mitzvah. But let's say he didn't put the parapet on the roof. Then it's only justifiable that God says, I'm taking away his house. He only got it to do the mitzvah. He doesn't want to do the mitzvah. I'm taking it away. What a lesson we can learn from that. The things that we have in life were given to us as a blessing. Probably because we did something good in life, that God is saying, you did one mitzvah, I'm giving you now a car. But you know why you got the car? In order that you could do mitzvot with the car. You can give people lifts. You could do Bikur Holim work. You could deliver packages. You could drive your children to school. You could do so much good. And that's why you got it. You have a home. Why did God give you a home? Probably because you did something good in your life. You did a mitzvah. Now God's giving you a home in order to do more mitzvot. You put a mezuzah in your house. Fine. You put a parapet. You have guests. You have rabbis. You have classes. But if you just take your blessings and say, no, I'm not doing any mitzvot, then God says, but this was a reward for a mitzvah, and this was a mitzvah itself. But you didn't do the mitzvah. God forbid it's taken away. And therefore you have to look at all the blessings in your life in that light. Specifically your children. If you have children, may they live and be well. It's a zechut to have children. It's the biggest privilege in life. And it's the greatest blessing. If God gave you that blessing, it's probably because you did something right somewhere along the lines. You did a mitzvah, so God said, you did one mitzvah, I'm going to give you a chance now to do more mitzvot. Our children are such an opportunity to good by teaching them the right ways, by sending them to the yeshiva, by teaching them right from wrong, by insulating them from culture. But when God, Chas v'Shalom, sees that parents are neglecting the mitzvah of their children, God says, this was a payback for a mitzvah, goreret mitzvah, you did good, I'm giving you another chance to do a mitzvah. But you let your children run the streets. Many years ago they used to have an advertisement on television. It wasn't for us, it was for the Abid. It's 10 o'clock, do you know where your children are? I used to see this to laugh. Who doesn't know where their children are at 10 o'clock? Somebody used to tell me, oh, that's for the Abid. They don't know where their children are, but we know where our children are. Today, they could put on the television, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, do you know where your children are? 3 o'clock in the morning, and they're still downstairs getting dressed for the party. God gave us children. If we don't guide them in mitzvot, if we don't guide them and use them to become soldiers of God, if we don't enlist them in this holy army, then already Borei Olam says, I gave you children because you did good, but you're not, it's like getting the house and not building the ma'akir. God says, finish, take away the house. Our children should live and be well. But that's dependent on parents. Parenting by proxy doesn't work. Just to say, well, they're running around, we'll ask them tomorrow morning what they did. In many cases, that's too late. And that's what the Torah is saying. Not only in your children, anything you have in life, you must use it and find out how you could transfer that to serve God. And then God will give you more blessing. The Gemara says, after you get the house, use it the right way. The next parasha talks about a garden. You'll have a garden now. Oh, what do you do in the garden? There's all laws in the garden. What you're allowed to plant, what you're not allowed to plant. You have to give money to the Kohanim, to the Levim. You treated the garden the right way. The next parasha talks about your clothes. God will give you nice clothes. Why? So you can check them for sharpness. So you can check them for wool and linen. Not so you can be the sharpest person. For the mitzvah. But you got clothes, you didn't check them for sharpness, so you blew it. The only reason why I gave it to you was, look at that. It started from a bird's nest, a house with a ma'akeh, a garden with mitzvot, a suit with shat. It's all mitzvot, mitzvot, mitzvot. But once you take out the life, which is the mitzvah, then already, God forbid, we lose it. And that's an important lesson that we must learn. To use all our blessings to channel it to the service of Borei Olam. Shabbat Shalom Baruch. Ladies, they ask for tzedakah, if you leave it on the table or wherever you like. Ladies, next Friday is the last class. In Deal, at least. Next Friday, 11:30, we have graduation.